Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
Let me put something else out on the table and make it very clear that, of course, none of what I say is to in any way undermine the basic right that everyone has, everyone always has had, and everyone always will have to take whatever precautionary measures they feel is necessary in order to prevent such a chain of infection from taking place, including isolating yourself in your own home, wearing whatever protective gear you want, socially distancing yourself from anyone you come in contact with, or anything else that you feel is appropriate to prevent such a chain of infection. Of course you have that right. But that negative right is now being flipped on its head into a positive obligation on everyone in society to stop all productive human activity, to lock everyone up in their homes, and to treat them as prisoners, tracking and surveilling everything that they do and everyone that they come in contact with on the basis of a hypothetical chain of infection that could take place. And I want that out on the table. If you agree with that principle and you think that is a good thing, then clearly state it. Clearly state that you agree with the abridgment of our most basic freedoms on the basis of this hypothetical chain of infection. And clearly state where your line in the sand is. What do you think would be going too far for the government to do on the back of such a pandemic panic? Biometric ID, tracing and tracking every movement of every citizen at all times for the rest of their lives? Or the ability to march into people's homes to check for potential infections and forcibly vaccinate them if need be? Or any other number of measures that are now coming into view as a result of this panic? Where is your line in the sand? Clearly state it so that when that line is crossed, people will see that you are a hypocrite for cheering it on. Unless there is no line in the sand, and you think that governments are justified in doing anything that any presumed health authority says in the light of a pandemic situation. But at least state it openly and on the record. Don't hide behind vague, fluffy, woolly language. Tell us what you, specifically, not the agents of the state to whom you outsource your violence, but you would do in order to prevent people from living their lives in the event of a pandemic. There's a lot to think about here, and I hope you will do so. And join me in clearly rejecting this principle that we are being asked to accept right now. And if you do so, I think we will be getting a lot closer to striking at the root of this evil. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, April 20th, and this is part four in our monthly. You know how sometimes around here we call things monthly, even if we do them a little less than every month exactly? But Jim Hood and I have been aiming for a monthly series. We're doing a pretty good job so far. Jim and his wife, Beth, have authored several books. and also produced a course designed to help young people discover more personalized and wiser paths into more fulfilling careers that favor hands-on experience over higher education. It's one of the things that we encourage most at School Sucks Project. So if you want to learn more about Test Drive Your Future, there are links in the show notes. Now, here's a couple of things about today's episode. Talking about the future, planning for the future. Of course, the future is always filled with near infinite possibility as far as successes and challenges and sources of happiness, but also grief and despair even. And lately, I think many people would agree that it seems like the contemplation of the future now incorporates many, many more variables and also more uncertainty than ever. So Jim and I will talk about how he has adjusted personally and professionally to this, but we're also going to run through, I would say, a series of critical explorations of what's happening right now that would be necessary in that decision-making process for young adults or parents. So this covers politics, profession, society, economy, and just like all the previous conversations with Jim, I think this show is a real adventure. We're also trying to offer some suggestions for curation of information. Who are we turning to and how are we vetting people in this time as we look for updates on everything that's happening in the world? One of the people that we discuss, of course, is the great James Corbett of Corbett Report. You heard him at the beginning of the show. There are several other media, mainstream and alternative outlets that we will talk about in a positive and negative light on the show today. And another feature of this discussion, Jim sent me a hi, how are you style email a few weeks ago, and he expressed some concerns. So we'll talk about what those concerns are. But towards the end of the conversation, we go in what I thought was very, very interesting and helpful direction on the topic of death. So thanks again to Jim Hood for another wonderful contribution to our conversation here. You can check out his work at testdriveyourfuture.com. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you again later this week.
Found a stack of blank pictures, passport out of hell. Left here by some stranger, seems to wish me well. Promontory rider, some kind of territory ranger. Asking, can you thread a needle? Can you shoot the moon? Walk the silver screen to your judgment at high noon.
Welcome back to School Sucks.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brett.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be continuing our Test Drive Your Future series here, even though it's very hard to do anything without talking about what's going on. And of course, what's going on in Hawaii, in New Hampshire, the country as a whole, the world as a whole, is very applicable in many ways to what we've been talking about here. But on the show today, I really just like we had been talking before we recorded in email and in person, and there's just so many aspects of this that we both want to cover that I thought it would be worth, even if we have to go long, even if we have to split this into a couple of parts, it would be good just getting everything out there, and I'm really eager to have this conversation with you and get your insights, so here we go.
Awesome. I've been looking forward to it.
So you sent me, I wanted to actually talk about this on the show. You sent me an email, I think it was almost a couple of weeks ago now, and you expressed some concern about how I was doing. And I thought that was interesting, but I just wanted to give you a minute to talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was the episode that you were doing with Paul Verge. And I think at the time you had just arrived. Were you staying with your parents? Is that what the situation was?
Yeah, I was staying with my mom. I was there almost a month. I was there from March 13th. Aside from a couple of weekends at like Airbnbs when that still seemed like it was a safe thing to do. Yeah, I've been there pretty consistently for about a month before I packed up my things and my significant other and I went up north to, as I was telling you, a county in New Hampshire that has 45 people per square mile. And I will be here until the end of April. And then I'll kind of, reassess the situation and plan what is next.
Hopefully people aren't looting your apartment back in Pennsylvania.
I got a guy staying there. I got a guy, my good friend, young Alex, who's been on the podcast a bunch of times, actually, is
awesome
at my house, collecting the mail, turning the lights on, Yeah. I don't know how long he's going to stay there, but he's there now. And we don't seem to have any degree of civil unrest in Pittsburgh yet. We do see the food lines building up in some places. And obviously that is step one in a multi-step process, but we'll see what that looks like. It's just, you know, I'm taking it day by day and week by week and trying to make a plan.
Interesting that you mentioned the food lines. I'd shared with you before that I have this unique situation with my voice where when I eat, I have this digestive issue that actually affects my voice and makes it very weak. And usually before we record these podcasts, I fast for a day or two, literally, just so I can make my voice strong enough to talk. And so I was fasting for the last 2 days. Mm-hmm. But I was also hiking a couple miles with my daughter, and I was getting up and doing these really intense weight workouts every morning, continuing to do that. And by yesterday afternoon, I was really damn hungry. And I got to thinking about the situation that we're in, and I'm like, my God, we are really, we're on the edge. I mean, I think the whole reason the country hasn't erupted into crazy civil unrest yet is they are still somehow managing to keep us really well fed. I mean, I'm sure you've done a fast before, and you just, after a few days, it's just like, everything smells good and everything sounds good. And it's like, oh my gosh. I mean, that's what's holding our society together right now are these really brave people who are working for $10 an hour at the grocery store. Thank goodness for them. But at any rate, getting back to your original question or observation, when you were talking with Paul a few weeks ago, I was just listening to that podcast, and it was so interesting to hear you talk about where you were right then. You know, what really stuck out to me is you'd said something about being annoyed by something that your mom was watching on TV, but you didn't even want to touch the television remote. You know,
At that time, the hardest thing to understand about this whole situation, like, I already have, I think, a worldview that is going to serve me well when it comes to the trustworthiness of media and government. But epidemiology is obviously a blind spot for me. And the basic understanding that I had that seemed to be reinforced by a lot of what we were talking about in the autonomy group, this virus was highly contagious. It had a long, long incubation period, unlike anything else that we've dealt with in our life, you know, like 2 and up to 14 days. So I go there to encourage, first of all, to make sure that preparation is occurring in people in my family who didn't think they needed to prepare, but also to go over a number of safety procedures that I was pretty sure my mom wasn't following when she told me as I was on my way out there that she was planning to go to the Boston Celtics game on the night that I was arriving. My dad's significant other was getting on a plane in Sarasota to fly to Logan Airport in Boston. And this is all happening around March 13th. Right. So I wanted to be, I don't know, a persuasive presence. And at that point, just to your question about not wanting to touch the remote, you know, observing what I didn't think was very careful behavior as far as handling packages, handling mail, being around nieces and nephews who had been in school as recently as a few days ago, maybe the first week that I was in that house, I was being very, very careful. I was wiping things down. And yeah, I wasn't touching anything that I didn't need to touch. So I was, I appreciated your input, but I was like, damn, you know, I didn't want to come across as like fearful or hypervigilant about this. You know, I was trying to project calm, but I guess it wasn't 100% successful, but that's good feedback anyway. And actually, you know, it was, there was just a period of settling into what was going on and then just having an inventory of doing the right things and understanding like, hey, this is the best I can do. This is what I'm capable of controlling in this situation. And that just brings a kind of calm that I would say I've enjoyed since then. Going up into the middle of nowhere was also helpful. But, you know, I understand I can't recommend that to everybody, obviously, but it was nice that I was able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we have the benefit of our 2020 hindsight. But yeah, those first few weeks were really intense. And I had to go get my driver's license renewed. My birthday was on March 20th. And that was the, you know, of course, my license lasted for 8 years and it had to expire that particular week. And that was the only, at that point, I'd been staying at home for almost 2 weeks. And I have to go to the DMV and stand in line with all those people and then go to the grocery store for the first time in a week. That was an intense day. Just not knowing what to expect and having participated in the autonomy conversations where, you know, we were hearing Richard Grove talk about how when he got home from the grocery store, he was like, you know, putting his shoes in bleach water and things like that, wiping down every single, I'm like, oh my gosh, am I being careful enough? I don't know. And like I
said, that's all very contextual, isn't it? Right. Yeah. Like it depends on where you are. So here I'll go into a convenience store, you know, like I'll still wipe stuff off when I leave, but that's not something I would do in like, you know, Salisbury, Massachusetts right now, which is another place that I was kind of traveling through recently. So, it depends on who you are, where you are, who you're going to be exposed to. There's lots of considerations for things like that, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And now that we've had a few weeks, both you and I have had time to, amass some resources that we really trust about what's going on and have been able to probably consume a lot of information that has shaped the way we're viewing things now. And I'm at the point where I've been sharing some of the things that I've been consuming with people. I've had a couple of people respond positively, but a lot of people just, they aren't even writing me back. And it's concerning and frustrating for me because I feel like there's this whole narrative that's being pushed in the mainstream media right now that is a lot of fear and possibly a lot of misinformation. Mm-hmm. And wanting to try to bring this alternative information to people like, wait, you know, the thing that really gets me, I shared this with you the other day, you'd probably seen anyway, about the way the CDC is actually counting the cases.
Which is obviously, and you can explain, please do explain that if anyone in the audience is unfamiliar, but obviously this is really contributing, I think, to people's uneasiness about this whole situation.
I've got a little quote from an article that said, let's see, are the number of deaths even reliable? CDC's guidelines for filling out death certificates. COVID-19 should be reported on the death certificate for all descendants, where the disease caused or is assumed to have caused or contributed to death. And so essentially it's saying that, yeah, if it doesn't matter if the person had been struggling with cancer for years or heart disease or whatever, if they think that the person might have COVID-19. They don't even have to do a test, but they can put it on the death certificate. Somebody in our Discord chat for autonomy posted something the other day. It was a picture of some legs and feet sticking out from the bottom of a steamroller. And it said, man run over by steamroller dies of coronavirus.
Yep, I've seen it. Man skydiving without a parachute dies of coronavirus. Yeah, this is becoming a real meme. So we have this misreporting coupled with other factors that I think are being overlooked in the reporting. And, you know, for years on School Sucks podcast, I've been promising that school does prepare people for citizenship. And, you know, what we're seeing is this kind of one size fits all over response, right? Where everybody is obligated to, you know, Tom Woods and I were talking about this last week. Everybody is obligated to stay inside, to follow these protocols when they're probably best suited to a very specific segment of the population. Also overlooking, like, as we see, there's lots of discussion right now is like, if this thing is so bad, why in so many countries, especially in Europe, excluding Italy, are like reported deaths basically on par with where they've been in years past. In New York City, we are seeing like twice the number of normal. So something is killing people in New York City for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
But what are the factors that are contributing to that? Even if it's beyond just like comorbidities and people being advanced in age, One of the things that I think is being most ignored, and I think there might even be, you know, some kind of politically correct motivation for doing this, is obesity. You know, Business Insider put out an article, I think yesterday or today, and the headline was, "Obesity is the biggest factor driving New York City's coronavirus hospitalizations after age," right? So it is the number two factor is obesity. And hardly anybody is, I mean, well, I shouldn't say hardly anybody, because probably everybody that we're listening to, that we're getting our news about this, is talking about obesity and diet and other kinds of exposures as far as air and water and food is concerned. But you don't hear any discussion of this. Like, you would think that what's happening in New York City could just be happening to anybody and everybody. And 30% of the country struggles with obesity. So again, a manipulation that is causing, I think, some level of confusion here.
Right. Yeah. I guess in that regard, I'm surprised we're not seeing more of it in Hawaii, because we are a pretty obese state. But then again, we're also in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and we've pretty much cut off contact with the world. So.
Right. Yeah, indeed. And the entire state has what, about 500 cases?
Yeah, I think it's 500 now. And we've got right now 11 active cases on the Big Island. I just checked it out this morning. I think out of the 500 cases, we've had 9 deaths. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, this has been, it's something I've struggled with for so, you know, these last few weeks. It's like wanting to share more with it seems to be another example of this, this culture where you're just kind of shutting people down, where I've wanted to share what I see as being very hopeful information. Hey, look, you know, the numbers of deaths aren't nearly as bad. The all these things that we've seen in the alternative media, people don't want to hear it, and they're just kind of shutting things down. And so I haven't shared as much as I would like, but I feel like there's a lot of hope in some of this alternative press that, yeah, I don't know. And here in Hawaii, especially, I mean, so we're on an island that's the size of Rhode Island and Delaware put together. I mean, it's the largest island in the United States. And we have had a total of 31 cases. We've got 11 that are active now, and, we've got the entire island shut down for the foreseeable future. As far as I know, I mean, they publish these maps every week. I don't even know that we've had a single case in our little town up here yet. They wouldn't allow me in the grocery store yesterday until I went home and got my mask.
Wow. Yeah. New Hampshire is not like that yet. And New Hampshire has actually been very slow to act in that way, just because I think the politics of the state. But one of the things that I think I've talked about in previous shows is, like, New Hampshire has at least 1,000 cases at this point, even though they're mostly in the southern part of the state with the counties that border Massachusetts and Maine. But there's a political culture here that is just like, all right, let's have a proportional response to what's actually happening. And that has not been that hasn't been the case nationwide, I don't think.
Right.
So as far as, like, you saying you're trying to share positivity with people, is that your primary piece of positive news about the death toll?
Well, in media that I've shared with people, yeah, I've been primarily sharing Del Bigtree, the Highwire show. That I don't know if you've been watching that the last couple of weeks, but my chiropractor actually shared that with me, and I have just found so much hope from what Del is bringing to people every Thursday, and so I've been sure to watch every episode, and then just take these little snippets. I'm like, okay, if you don't have 2 hours to watch the whole thing, then watch from, you know, minute 10 to minute 18, and tell me what you think. You know, yeah. That's primarily what I haven't been doing a lot of outreach in regards to the message for Test Drive Your Future. And what I had been talking with you about or shared in some of my notes over the weekend about some of the reflection that I've been doing and some of the spiritual side of all of us. I haven't really shared that with anyone either, but had a lot of fun actually putting together some notes in regards to things that have been floating through my head since all of this started.
Yeah, and I appreciated them. And it actually lined up with a lot of things that I had been seeing and looking into. And it's really hard to, at this point, I think it is a challenge to build a coherent picture because this is this sort of ever-evolving event. And if you think about other times where events took place that would permanently change the relationship between people in government or the culture or the politics in some way, right? So we have like political assassinations in the 1960s, 9/11, just come to mind as like decent previous examples, the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the terrorist attacks on 9/11. These events were finite. They happened and then they were over. And in fact, 9/11 dragged on for a whole day pretty much before people like knew it was over, that nothing else was coming. And then obviously the fear and the campaign of fear generation around it went on for several months after that. But in the early goings of these kinds of events, like, so there's a documentary that people could go check out when they have like 5 or 6 hours of time. I've never been able to find it in any better quality than like 360p, but it's called Evidence of Revision. It's about the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert F. Kennedy. And it is all the examples of early media stories that conflict what became the official narrative in the JFK case of the Warren Commission, right? Or in the investigations that took place in the later assassinations of RFK and Martin Luther King. Now, this is often, and it certainly was the case with 9/11, considered to be cause for suspicion if people are reporting different things, seeing different things, hearing different things in the very early stages of a developing event. So this event has this like slower play to it where it's just going on and it's very hard. I mean, we've been dealing with this at this point for a month. So trying to, I think, make sense of the entire thing, to build a coherent picture of the entire event, the government response, the implications for the public in terms of social unrest, the economy, the epidemiology, like to build a coherent picture of all of that is going to be extremely difficult right now. So I have tried, just in my approach, to be extremely cautious and talk about things from my sphere of control. But once you, and I think we're both kind of there at this point, develop some, you know, acceptance and even serenity of like, regarding the whole situation, you start to ask questions. And the show that I did with Tom Woods last week was the first time where it's like, okay, I'm starting to experience a lot of curiosity, and that curiosity is bringing a lot of agitation and even suspicion about what I'm... And even then, I was like, there are a lot of things here that are really fishy. But whenever there's a massively complex event that has lots of aspects that lots of people are not going to understand, things are going to seem fishy. And I'm just trying to remember that. It doesn't mean I don't think things are fishy. It just means that you're going to have a posture of suspicion when there's this ever-changing, ever-expanding, vastly complex, and somewhat abstruse, in many aspects of it are anyway, event that is, you know, unfolding in front of you every day. So trying to put together a whole theory of what is going on here has been a challenge. And I felt like for me, even though I'm getting more and more willing to talk about it on the show and to theorize and even speculate a little bit on the show, as long as it is clear that that's what we are doing, and this is like people going through the process of trying to make sense of what's going on here, not claiming to have all the answers, like some are. At this point, I think that that is permissible as long as it's explicit. That is what we are doing. But those misunderstandings about events as they were developing, I think, led to a lot of confusion in those more finite occurrences like a political assassination or a terrorist attack. So we're kind of just in this
this cycle of this thing that is, we don't know how long it's going to go on, but there are more and more aspects of it that are starting to come into focus. And there are more and more causes of suspicion that I think more and more people need to be talking about. And the fact that people are doing that, that's actually, as long as it's not just perpetual noise generation, the fact that there does seem to be more suspicion in the public than what we experienced 20 years ago with 9/11, I would say that is generally a good thing, as long as
absolutely,
you know, directed, right? And as long as it's responsible, rational, and directed. And I know that's a lot to ask for, but we can at least try to do our part here.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing that the stuff that I've been watching, like I said, the High Wire with Del Bigtree, he has been sharing a lot of really credible information from a lot of very reputable people. I mean, the episode that it was like 2 weeks ago, and he had quotes from six or seven of the top virologists and epidemiologists in the world, you know? And it's like, so when I'm sharing these things with people, I'm like, I just wanted to share this video with you. This isn't me saying this. This is some of the top scientists on the planet who are saying this. And then at the end of that same episode, they had an economist who was talking about the economic implications of all of this, where, you know, you get to this level of unemployment and then you start to have this level of suicide and depression and hunger and all of these other things that come as a result of an economic catastrophe. And again, it's just like, it's not, I'm not at the point really where I'm trying to paint a comprehensive picture of what's going on. I'm just trying to find the best sources of information I can to figure out what seems to be going on, and what is being said in the mainstream media versus what is being said by some of these top experts. And I guess in that regard, I've been able to paint a picture for myself, not something that I'm, like I said, that's comprehensive, but it's something that has allowed me to have a lot more peace and a lot more confidence. I'm no longer afraid to go out and get groceries and to run errands. I've even seen a couple of clients in person. Mm-hmm. Respecting social distancing and whatnot, but speculating about what's going on in an overarching way is all well and good. But I think it's going to be a really long time before we're able to put all that together. Especially some of the broader implications. I mean, not just the virus itself, but the what's going on with the economic system. I'm not sure how much you've been following that, but I've been watching Corbett Report like every single day, and the stuff that James is talking about. Holy cow!
Yeah, so let's take it piece by piece, and let's actually start with the High Wire with Dale Bigtree, excuse me. He is somebody that I've actually tried to, at least as far as the show is concerned, keep at arm's length for a while. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of liability, I think, in talking about vaccines. Obviously, he calls his show the High Wire for a reason, right?
Right.
What he's doing is like risky, and he's saying, look, I'm willing to walk this for everybody who might be afraid to. And as I've said to people privately, I don't have a dog in that fight. I don't have children of my own. All my vaccines were done 40 years ago.
Right.
The risk versus reward, like, or what I stand to gain from talking about it, while I honestly feel it would take me years of research to be in a position where I could advise people responsibly on such a thing. So I understand Del Bigtree's background. I know he was involved with the show The Doctors. I know he started seeing lots of things that he considered that set off alarms for him. And then he kind of went this other route. So when I saw that he was talking about this, and obviously there's all of this discussion led by the Gates Foundation and the World Health Organization around the development of a vaccine some 12, 18 months from now, whatever, I saw, okay, here's a guy who's already got skin in the game. And you see a lot of people right now, I think I might have said this in one of my recent the show I put out today with James Davis, a lot of people are kind of seizing this moment to say, look, I've been right for 20 years. This is what I've always been talking about. Here's everything, you know, coming together. And this is just a place where I think people need to be especially cautious, because
right. It
is possible to cherry pick pieces of information if you already know the narrative you want. But I have watched High Wire, and you know, the person who sent me the first episode, I wrote back to them. I said, you know, this actually makes me feel better too. It did in the moment. I think not to be a party pooper on this whole thing about the virus not being as, you know, deadly or transmissible as people might have initially claimed. When you still look at like the political and economic implications of most people believing that and most people being led to believe that, I don't necessarily think that's a silver lining or a positivity. In fact, a friend of mine, I don't know if you know Daryl Becker, fellow Hawaiian.
I do. Yeah, okay, he lives on this island.
Yes, great. I'm glad you guys know each other. So
we do.
You know, he and I were talking early on, and he said, you know, if this is some level of concoction, that's not good news, right? That's not good because what is it? What is the aim? What is it possibly going to be used for? So it was just an interesting, I don't think he was offering a conclusion, but it was certainly a thought-provoking, a worthwhile exploration, like to think about that. So I don't necessarily get much comfort from thinking that all of these like NGOs and government, like the Gates Foundation, and then these super government organizations that are, you know, part of the UN, all working to pump up fear about this, would it that it's a good thing if the fear is unfounded, because like, what's it being pumped up for? You know what I mean?
Right.
Especially when we transition into talking about government response and economic outcomes. Yeah. None of that looks good. So I watched, I think that episode of High Wire that you sent me, I think I had actually seen pieces of that earlier, but as far as the numbers that he showed, and it, again, acknowledging that some cherry picking could be going on, where if somebody is just showing me six quotes from six different guys, there's a lot they're not showing me, right?
Right.
If they're showing me like 10 to 12 lines of a thing a guy said at some point in time or a woman said at some point in time, there's obviously a lot that is not there, especially when the narrative that that thing is going to fit into has already been constructed. But, you know, this was a bombardment that went on for like 2 hours where he had, you know, all of this information that his team had put together. And yeah, this was actually one of the, I think the first time that I saw this episode that you sent me was probably from a couple of weeks ago, where it was showing like what is normal as far as, you know, death tolls in certain countries or in certain places month by month. And the only country that is like out of proportion is Italy,
right?
In 2020. And in fact, in 2017, all the Scandinavian countries were off the charts compared to where they are now.
Yep.
So, and of course, one of those countries is Sweden that has taken a very different approach. And that's something that we can talk about as well. But just as far as like the science or the vaccination or the epidemiologists of this through the lens of Del Bigtree, is there anything else you think we should talk about there before we move on? Because I definitely want to get into the political economist that he talked to.
Oh, sure. Did you see his presentation at Red Pill last year?
Mm-mm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was fascinating just watching Del speak. Basically, the premise of his talk was we have mandated vaccines, or we're heading towards mandated vaccines. Certain states have already done that for children. And he's been saying for years that the next thing to come is going to be mandated vaccines for adults. And
right.
And he's been speaking a lot about how this could be the opening that they've been looking for to do that. Whether that's true or not, I mean, I have no idea. But the thing that really and I do have skin in this game because I have a 5-year-old daughter. I'm not going to get into to all of that. But I will say that I have done a tremendous, tremendous amount of research about this. And I consider myself to be fairly well-educated, you know, as far as a parent is concerned in this regard. But what really concerns me is what they're talking about with a possible coronavirus vaccine is this being the first RNA vaccine that they're attempting to develop. And from what I've read and I understand, they've been attempting to do this since the early 1990s, and they've not yet been able to create a successful vaccine using this technology. Ones that they've tried have caused horrible side effects.
Lots of carnage. Yep.
Lots of problems. And yet this vaccine is being spoken about as if it's the Holy Grail. Like we literally can't reopen society and expect life to go back to normal until after, you know, 18 months and we've got this thing developed, you know, never mind the fact that it will have mutated, you know, umpteen times between now and then.
Right. While everybody working on it, while it's being talked about in the media as if it's a savior, everybody working on it behind the scenes is asking for indemnification. Right.
Right.
Like the Gates Foundation. And I think that would be typical anytime that you're doing something that's urgent and fairly experimental. I don't think that's necessarily the most nefarious thing in the world. But if you're doing something that has a high risk as far as like side effects or negative outcomes, yeah. You could stand to have all this liability in forms of lawsuits. If you're willing to take the risk to develop the thing, or if you're willing to do the work to develop the thing, you should, I would think you would want to have a way to minimize your risk. But I wish that was more a part of the conversation was more balanced between like, yeah, they want this thing and it might be good, but just, you know, also pay attention to the fact that Bill Gates is, you know, working behind the scenes to get indemnification from anything going wrong. So
right.
Yeah. But yeah, and my understanding too is that vaccines have also, like, I think the first obstacle that people encounter here is it's like, this is medical, you know, this is like pharmaceuticals, or, you know, I don't worry about taking my mom to the hospital and hooking her up to a dialysis machine and having it rip her leg off, right? It's safe. Right. And, you know, most people, most adults anyway, can take some drugs without terrible consequences. I mean, if you get into kids taking drugs, that's a different story. But people, I'm more skeptical than most people, but I think most people just assume that like medical equipment, medical devices, pharmaceutical drugs are fairly safe, or they wouldn't be available for the public. Even if we've seen like an opioid crisis develop in this country over the last decade that is directly a result of this ignorance. But right. I think that is a mindset that most people approach vaccines with, even though you look at all of the carnage of pharmaceutical drugs and all of the mismanagement of hospitals that lead to people's death. These things, vaccines have an even lower threshold of safety in testing than that. And my understanding is that vaccines have also changed away from, you're going to have to help me with the vocabulary, because this is like, I just have a very basic knowledge of this, like dead particle, where they're actually injecting the disease to build immunity into something, and now they're like more chemical.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Like okay. An attenuated virus versus, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I know what you're saying.
So there are, it's not like, no, I don't think anybody has ever said that all vaccines are toxic and bad, but vaccines have changed. And what we're seeing now is a change that is even more of a departure away from the vaccines that worked.
Yeah. I mean, with the RNA thing, I mean, they're talking about injecting something into people that will literally change our genetic makeup permanently. I mean, it's never been done before. And we have such a basic understanding of how our genetics work. I mean, like, what could possibly go wrong? I mean,
right. My goodness. I mean, my imagination just opened up right there, because right. Like, I don't even know what could go wrong or how horrible it could be.
Mm-hmm. It's just such a little, I mean, even within mainstream medicine, I mean, the field of epigenetics has just come up within, you know, the last two decades, you know, where when they sequenced the genome back in the late 90s and the early 2000s, they're like, oh, well, you know, there's, you know, this part of the DNA that is active. And then there's like huge chunk of junk DNA, they called it, that doesn't appear to be doing anything. And they have since subsequently figured out that part of our DNA can be turned on and off like a light switch, you know, based on our environment, based on foods, all those things. So there was this huge chunk of our genome that they didn't understand and just assumed that it was, you know, not doing anything. And that has changed completely. I mean, and so how could we go from not knowing something that significant to then thinking like, oh, well, now we're going to be able to just go in and make this precision change and everything will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
We're not going to test it much first, but trust us. Well, it'll be fine.
Well, and now we have a situation where there's no time, you know?
Right.
I mean, that would obviously be a usable excuse in this, mm-hmm. in this case. So from there, this is one theater of response, right? The medical, right. If we want to call it that. The other is the legal, And we've covered that a little bit, but I wanted to talk about the economic, right? So there was this, we just started to talk about this political economist that Del Bigtree actually interviewed a couple of weeks ago. His name was Toby Rogers. You know, he was saying that it's kind of outrageous the stance the media has taken against Trump in this case, where, I don't know, I think what we're seeing here is really irresponsible, where Trump says something like he doesn't want the cure to be worse than the disease. And people act like they're baffled by that. Like, what does that even mean? Is that just fear-mongering? Is that being anti-vax? Is that being anti-science? When Trump might have just been speaking very generally, like the cure is all of these aspects, and maybe he wasn't, but like for our purposes here, like let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Like right. The cure is every form of response to this thing. And, you know, one form has been, as far as response is concerned, basically, I don't want to be hyperbolic and say everyone's locked in their house. It certainly doesn't feel that way where I am. And I bet it doesn't feel that way many places in the country, but the economy right. has largely been shut down, where half of Americans have either lost significant hours at work, had their pay cut, or lost their jobs outright. I think it was also in that interview where he said half of small businesses, if the economy stays in this state, half the small businesses in the country, you know, that operate kind of on the margin will fail in the next 3 months. Half right. the small businesses in this country will fail in the next 3 months. So the implications that this political economist, Toby Rogers, were discussing, this, now I will be hyperbolic. From what he was saying, it sounds like this almost amounts to democide.
Mm.
You know? Now, this is something that libertarians have, unfortunately, and I would advise against kind of delighting in, looking at the democide numbers of the 20th century, where communist governments killed hundreds of millions of their own citizens. And it seems completely incomprehensible, but this is a way that it could happen and result in possibly, you know, over the course of, if they really go as hard as they're talking about going, right, with like the Imperial College of London recommendations, I mentioned that in the show last week as well, where we might see a shutdown lasting up to 18 months, or like I think I mentioned in another show, a cycled shutdown, a sort right. of rhythmic shutdown where, okay, everyone can go outside, okay, everybody back inside, as like ICU admissions go up and down, and the public is just constantly caught in that conditioning loop. I think that could be really ugly as well. But if things stay as they are, where I don't know how many people at this point, it's got to be approaching 20 million have filed for unemployment.
Yeah, I think so.
In the last 2 or 3 weeks, that is obviously not sustainable. And do you remember what Toby Rogers was saying about the relationship between increase in unemployment and death?
Oh my gosh, I remember what he said. I don't remember the specific number though. It was like for every point the unemployment rate went up, it was, what was it, 1,000 suicides or something like that?
Well, the number that he put forth in the show was that a 1% increase in unemployment, and he was able to find a strong causal relationship here, would, with a 5-year lag time, result in like 36,000 new deaths.
Okay.
A lot of which he called deaths of despair. So obviously, people's, you know, just medical things like people's blood pressure would go up. There might be a higher propensity to develop illness because of inflammation, all these other things. But deaths of despair would be like alcoholism, drug abuse, prescription drug abuse, suicide. And that's with a 1% increase in unemployment.
Right.
Okay. So if we're talking about, I can't even calculate the percent increase, but we're talking about 20% of people unemployed.
Right. I think we were at 3% before. I mean, at least the official statistics.
Right. And I'm not sure what it is officially now. Yeah. I mean, this is Trump saying he doesn't want a cure in this case being what causes these economic problems to be worse than the disease. But there we are.
And this is where it's so difficult to have conversations with people, because they immediately hop on that, but people will die argument. I don't even know what to say about that other than to say, here, watch this, you know, 20-minute segment with this economist where he explains it in great detail, because I'm not too able to explain it as well as he did. But that's the first thing that comes up is, but people will die if we reopen the economy.
This will be the last time I mention Tom Woods, I think. But did you happen to hear that show?
I did. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the reason why I wanted to talk to him about it was that Facebook post that he made, that I wanted him to elaborate on this and be able to use that as a talking point when we get shamed for asking questions about what's happening right now. What makes life worth living? Is life just having a pulse and drawing breath? You know, that he said there's this biological life and then there's life with a soul. And I think that's a really, really important thing, perfectly reinforced by what this political economist, again, his name is Toby Rogers, what he said on that Highwire interview. It's right. Like once you, it's what Andrew Yang was saying when he was on Joe Rogan like a year and a half ago. He's like, we better come up with a plan for people, you know, who have meaning. And whether Andrew Yang was right or not, just take his point as, if people lose a huge part of their sense of purpose and they can't, because of a crisis, immediately translate it into something else, that's going to be bad, especially for, you know, men in this country who are like between 35 and 45 years old. You're going to see a lot of them kill themselves or develop right. substance abuse problems. So, yeah, I think that is something that needs to be a consideration, but I'm really... Here's the turning point for me with somebody like Del Bigtree, right? Now, I'll be honest. Like, I know we have lots of mutual friends who are like, Del Bigtree is the greatest guy. And when I was at Red Pill, I was like, I'm staying away from this guy, right? I don't want anything to do with this guy. I don't want anything to do with this topic. I'm not going there. I'm not talking about that on my show. There's no place for that. But after watching a few episodes of his show, and you see whether he's pushing some kind of narrative or agenda or not, he is modeling skepticism, right? Mm-hmm. And anybody, as long as you have some intellectual self-defense skills, anybody who is modeling skepticism right now is potentially somebody that you can have an alliance with.
Right.
Compare that to sweet, kind Ellen DeGeneres in her little Ellen show, right? I think Ellen just seems like the nicest, sweetest, most innocent person. And I hope I'm right that she actually is. And her show is just used as a platform, you know, just like that show with those women, The View.
The View, yeah.
You know, so if you just want to, like, what's the most basic left-wing opinion on every issue in the country right now, that show's your place, right? Lots of people watch that show. But Ellen right. has a really, really powerful platform. But she doesn't seem like she has a lot of depth of understanding of anything that she's talking about as far as it relates to like current events or politics or economics or society or anything, right?
Right.
She's just a nice lady that everybody trusts. Mm-hmm. So you watch her interview Bill Gates and she says things like she speaks for her audience to Bill Gates. I'm afraid to go outside. I'm afraid to go back to the way life was until there's the medical interventions that you and the World Health Organization, Bill, are talking about. Comfort me. I mean, that is the right. tone of the interview. And I don't even, I mean, I've seen interviews with like, you know, Richard Haass from the Council on Foreign Relations done by Katie Couric. And it's almost like this is a script they're each reading. This is completely right. synthetic. This doesn't even appear to be like a real interview at all. But I don't have any reason to think that Ellen isn't genuine, but she's there because she is genuine. If she started to question what she was doing, somebody else would be sitting there doing that show.
Right.
You right. know? Yeah. So nothing against her. I like her. She just doesn't know anything.
Right.
I mean, and you know, she knows how to be a great comedian and have a great television show mm-hmm. and how to do, you know, fun and feel good interviews with celebrities, but she doesn't know anything about this. And that's clear in this interview.
I still don't. I mean, I can't wrap my head around if we don't really have a cure for it. Like, you know, I'm doing my show from my house mm-hmm. and as a lot of other people, you know, that have shows are able to do. But I can't imagine having an audience all kind of sitting next to each other and that being Because also, isn't it possible that it comes back in the fall?
Well, we don't know how seasonal it is. So that would actually be good news. That is, that if the force of infection went down in the summer, that would make this thing of getting the case numbers way down. So we start opening up. That would actually make it easier. But you're right. Then we'd have to pay attention to it coming back. But there are ways of doing that, that China is showing, South Korea is showing, that the risk of infection is very, very low. So you might be back in your studio because the way the workers engage with each other and the amount they can be tested to make sure nobody's infectious will be very different than what we have today. You may or may not have the audience. I would guess that will take a lot longer than going back to the studio for the filming itself.
You know, speaking of that, I mean, there's no cars on the road, very few planes. I mean, it's obviously affecting the economy in a bad way, but the planet is benefiting from this. And I know that's been important, the environmental issue for you. I mean, we have, they just said the air in Los Angeles is cleaner than it's ever been in the history of, I mean, ever. That's amazing.
Yeah, I wish that all our jobs could be done from home as well as your job and my job.
And you don't see Bill Gates debating anybody about this. When you see these people with these agendas talking to know-nothings about this situation, that's very scary.
Right.
But that's public opinion informed right there.
That is television programming.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I hadn't seen that, but it's your son. So like you said, whether Ellen is just a nice lady and is just, you know, nescient about these issues, or whether she's, we may never know whether she's doing that intentionally or, you know, she really just honestly doesn't know, but the outcome is the same regardless, that she's got an audience of millions of people who trust her, and those ideas have been placed in their minds. You know, we're feeling this fear. We're feeling this anxiety. We're looking for a savior. And then, you know, there's Bill riding in on his white horse.
Right. So we've talked about a lot of reasons for, I don't know if it's outright despair, but certainly like frustration and concern here, right? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some reasons to be like optimistic.
Well, we're all stuck at home. We've got a lot of time on our hands. And so what I'm encouraging people to do with Test Drive Your Future is to take advantage of this time that you're home, you're no longer involved in sports and extracurricular activities, things like that. And so you've got a lot of time available to you that you could be making good use of instead of watching Netflix or playing video games. Or I'm trying to see it as much as possible as a gift, not just for the people who are in my audience with Test Drive Your Future, but for myself and you know, families all over the country. I've got a 5-year-old daughter who's in preschool, and you know, this up until this crisis, this was one of the busiest years that I've had in regards to work, and I was so thankful that I had the preschool. We were able to send our daughter off at 8 o'clock in the morning. We pick her up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that gave us a lot of time to work. And that has all stopped. You know, the preschool is closed, and now my wife and I are trying to run our businesses, and not only just take care of her, but trying to provide her with some sort of educational enrichment. I mean, she's only 5 and they're doing very simple things at preschool, but we're trying to still provide that stimulation for her. And this has been really interesting for me in regards to the fact that, I mean, I've been listening to your show for years and I've been reading books about home education and I've been thinking, but we've had our daughter in preschool all this time. And we'd spent months last year debating about whether we were actually going to try to educate Nora at home once she came of kindergarten age, or whether we were going to send her to a school. We had decided to send her to a little local private school for next year, but now this has happened, and who knows how long things are going to be closed, and who knows if, you know, after a period of time of doing this, we might rethink that. I mean, I'm personally really enjoying the time that I'm spending with Nora. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going out for hikes. I'm teaching her how to read music, teaching her how to play piano. We taught her how to ride a bicycle last week. It's been amazing having this extra, just playing with her, just playing dolls. It's a rare time. I mean, like I said, things were so busy earlier this year, and you don't have kids, they, you know, when they say that they grow up so fast, it's absolutely true. And I, although before I felt like I was being there for her as much as I could and trying to enjoy this young, innocent, sweet, wonderful time period that she's in right now, mm-hmm. I had no idea what that really meant until we got to this recent circumstance. And now I'm hanging out with her for half of my day every day. And I don't really spend a lot of time on Facebook, but at the beginning of this crisis, I was just kind of scrolling through my newsfeed, you know, some of my high school and college friends. And I was seeing, you know, moms sitting down and teaching their kids how to sew with a sewing machine and how to, you know, put up a tent or how all these, I'm like, oh my gosh. My brother-in-law is a dairy farmer in Vermont, and he's like, I know there's a lot of farm chores, but nothing seemed more important today than, you know, building a teepee with my kids and playing cowboys and Indians. You know, it's just like,
yeah, yeah.
So cool. So I'm looking for ways that we might be able to, again, really take advantage of this situation to have people grow closer together as families and to maybe think beyond this current crisis as much as possible. And this, I've really struggled with this. I mean, as I've been working, like, you know, I've been working on Test Drive Your Future for 10 years and for years, it's like, okay, well, you know, you just kind of dial this back and figure out what your interests are, figure out, you know, how you might want to plug into something that involves those interests as a career a little bit down the line, you know, how you might get trained for that and whatnot. And right now, it seems that everything is up in the air. I mean, we don't have any idea what, you know, so a lot of my advice to young people is, you know, in regards to test driving your future is actually going out into the world and mixing it up with professionals who are doing what they say they want to do. And it's like, okay, well, first of all, there aren't any businesses open right now. Second of all, are these businesses even going to be around in 3 or 6 months? Are these careers even going to be available? It's a difficult time in regards to providing very specific advice as to how anyone, I mean, not just young people, but anyone who's looking to go out and kind of map their future as to what they should do. But that doesn't prevent somebody from actually taking that reflective, introspective time to really dial in, you know, who you are and what you want out of life, and to at least make a list of ways that you might be able to act on that once this lockdown is over.
Right. It doesn't necessarily have to completely crush whatever desires that you have. If you inventory those things, you could maybe find a way, I think.
Right.
That's still perfectly reasonable.
Absolutely.
So what is Test Drive Your Future look like now? You were talking about reforming it a little bit for this.
Well, we've taken advantage of kind of the downturn in regular work that we've been doing to completely recreate the website. I've just kind of recreated a new version of the course. I'd taken out a lot of, I put in a lot of things last year when I got involved in autonomy to kind of build it up and to really increase student interaction with not only me, but with each other, and throwing in some extra things that would have caused the course to be more expensive. I think the tools that I had suggested in the course were very valuable, but they did add to the hours that it would take for me to facilitate a young person's journey and actually bringing in some third-party experts that they could interact with, you know, learning how to interview or write resumes or cover letters, present themselves in a certain way. And so I've essentially kind of stripped out as much of that stuff as I possibly can to bring the cost of the course down to make it accessible to a lot more people. And especially during this time where a lot of people are feeling the pinch, they might not necessarily have the money to invest in a high-end course. So I've tried to make it as affordable, even for people who might be on a tight budget. They're like, oh yeah, well, I see that this would be valuable enough that we could squeak that into the budget this month.
Right. And I also think that, you know, you're in a good position with this because there's obviously going to be not only a demand, like a really genuine need for more alternatives to higher education. This is one of the things that was like in our prep for the show, Campus Reform, right? The piece from Campus Reform on colleges just bleeding money. I think that was the title. Colleges nationwide are bleeding money. Some might not make it. A lot won't make it, especially considering the stimulus bill has like, I don't know, $15 billion for higher education. And how have these institutions fared taking money from the government over the last several decades? Has it made them better? Has it made education more effective in these institutions? No, it's just caused a ton of unnecessary bloat, just like in the lower levels of education. And, you know, this could be the storm that, that sinks this ship, by and large, I think. So
how interesting would that be?
I mean, it would be. Yeah. And obviously, there's a lot of negative outcomes for that. Just like whenever you're given any of these push a button scenarios and asked, would you push it? There are a lot of considerations before you push. And yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of good people, a lot of people who are really committed to education and helping young people that would suffer in that process. But there's a lot of garbage that would also blow away.
Right.
And yeah, it's interesting to think about, and it will certainly be interesting to see what kind of like continuing education world emerges from all this. But yeah, I mean, what is it? April 15th today, and mm-hmm. everybody is home from college already. So I wanted to ask you, I didn't get to see one thing that you sent me was this Tucker Carlson story about how this, what this current crisis is exposing about higher education. Do you have like an executive summary of that?
Oh, yeah, I watched it actually just before we started talking here. And,
oh, nice.
And he essentially was saying, so here we have every college student home right now, and they're all being shown that it's possible to deliver higher education in an entirely different way. And he went on about, in particular, he was talking about Stanford and Harvard, how these, in spite of the fact that these schools are sitting on multi-billion dollar endowments, are not refunding the students really anything, not only for their you know, tuition, but some of the, in some cases, they're not even refunding room and board costs. And students are like, well, wait a minute, you know, what, I'm still paying the same amount for this really high dollar university, but I'm essentially sitting at home watching a class on Zoom. You know, this is, wouldn't yep. be any different than buying a class on Udemy or something like that. And he was talking about schools apart from Harvard and Yale, like who are in these situations where they're experiencing these massive losses, that maybe they will just go away and it will open up. And because there's still going to be a need for higher education. There's still going to be a need for you know, career preparation and training, but this will open up opportunities for other alternatives to begin to proliferate. And
right. So you can't get rid of, not that you would want to get rid of MIT necessarily, or colleges like MIT, Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. You can't do robotics at home, I don't think, not yet right. anyway. So higher education will certainly exist, but again, massive amounts of, I don't want to say fat will be trimmed, as if like fat is something that we need to get rid of.
I laughed a little bit during the, I'm all about the fat.
Yeah, but, that's my dietary bias right there. But yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Same here. I was thinking about you when I was watching it earlier. As one of the quotes from that Tucker clip is, what's a college degree worth these days? Degrees from certain schools or in certain subjects like medicine will always be worth it. But a communications degree from a mid-tier college, worthless.
Mm-hmm.
So...
That's me.
That's you. And I'm the psychology degree from the mid-tier university. And good. I mean, maybe all of that stuff, well, I mean, not all of it, but maybe a good portion of that stuff will be washed away and people will just begin to realize that it's not necessary. There are other ways, there are better ways, there are more efficient ways, there are less expensive ways to obtain a similar result or a much better result in probably a lot of cases.
Absolutely. So there's more I want to talk about, but we will be more I want to talk about today, but in our future episodes, we'll be revisiting like Test Drive Your Future and updates there. I did want to just get more of your personal feelings and takeaways from this situation.
Oh, yeah, that would be my pleasure. And I've been nervous about talking about this because it's a part of myself I haven't really shared with very many people. And here I am sharing it with your audience of thousands. But the last few weeks have been really, really profound for me. What kicked it off, I mean, what really made me think about it again was that episode that you did with Paul Verge, and I heard what you were talking about. And like you'd said earlier in the episode, you know, you were wanting to project that you were being careful and you were wanting to share with people ways that they could protect themselves during this crisis. But what I had heard or what my takeaway from it was, I'm like, oh my gosh, Brett's scared. He's afraid for his life to some degree. I mean, he's left his home in Pennsylvania and moved to a place where he feels more safe. He's taking all these precautions, which are, of course, intelligent. But being, you know, you're an influencer, you're a thought leader. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, this, you sometimes you build up people, you know, such as yourself, to be a little more invincible or bulletproof or, you know, something like that. And you, I saw you sharing your vulnerable side. Mm-hmm. And what I was thinking about was my own experience. And I'd shared with you just a little bit about it, that a couple of years ago, I had a bit of a multi-pronged health challenge. It actually ended up being not much, but I essentially have a sensitivity to dietary histamines. And those come from, there are high levels of histamines in any food that's like aged, you know, like sauerkraut, or you're talking like deli meats, things mm-hmm. like that, you know, canned fish, anything that has been sitting around for a while. I mean, apparently you kill an animal to eat it. And even though the animal is no longer alive, somehow the histamine level continues to rise in those foods after the fact. And the fall of 2018, I was having these periods of anxiety where I would just wake up in the middle of the night in an absolute panic. And that culminated in when I had learned about this condition that I have with my voice. I actually went and got scoped. They sent a camera down my throat to see what was going on. And in the process of that, they rub something wrong or scraped it or something. And I had this swelling and this constriction in my airway for the better part of the week. And I can't think of very much that is scarier than having trouble breathing. I mean, cause you can't live for a couple minutes without oxygen. Right. So in my case, you couple that with this anxiety that I was having about this dietary sensitivity that I didn't know that I had. And thank goodness I had gone back to Vermont and visited with an old friend of Beth's who had this exact same condition. And I called him up. I learned about it. I talked to his doctor about what was going on, was able to change my diet, and it went away. But there was this period of time in right around Halloween of 2018 where I had this absolute like paranoid fear. Like I was able to pretty much function throughout the day, but as soon as the sun started going down, as soon as that darkness was creeping in, I had this anxiety that was welling up every night. And it kind of, you know, I'm having trouble breathing because of this constriction in my airway. And I've got this anxiety going on because of the dietary thing. And it was to the point there for a few days where I was afraid that I was going to die in my sleep. I was having trouble, you know, every night, it would get closer to bedtime and I would start to feel this panic overcoming me. And, for a few nights, what I would end up having to do is, I would be downstairs. We're in a two-story house. My wife would go upstairs to bed and I would be downstairs in my living room pacing in a circle for like sometimes an hour or two, literally trying to build up the courage to go up to my bedroom and go to bed for the night. Yeah. And it was the scariest time of my life. You know, I eventually got over it. I was able to, for a while, I couldn't sleep with the door closed. I had to sleep with the lights on. I was just afraid that for whatever reason, I wasn't going to wake up. And thankfully I came out of that. But having had a lot of time to reflect on that, I see that as an incredible gift I was given, because I'm 44. I just turned 44 on March 20th, and I was 42 at the time, and it was the first kind of experience that I'd had with the idea of my own mortality. You know, we you know, when we're young, we think we're invincible, we're going to live forever, whatever. And I mean, it's there are people who have much more dramatic or worse, you know, near death experience stories than what I just shared. But for me, it was right there. It was very real. And I honestly, you know, was afraid that I just wasn't going to wake up the next morning. And so I've done a lot of reading and study around that. And I felt like I'd got myself to a really good place. And I was reading about it last night, and in the book, they were sharing the story with this other guy who had a near-death experience. And you go through that and you have this like awakening, you know, where everything is, you know, life is amazing. Life is beautiful. You're so grateful for everything. And then after a while it, you know, life returns to normal. Everything becomes more mundane, and you kind of, that experience doesn't have the weight and the effect that it did at one time. And that had kind of happened to me. And then this whole coronavirus thing started. And suddenly, you know, I told you earlier, I had to go out and get a new driver's license that week of my birthday. And then, you know, I hadn't gone to the grocery store in 2 weeks. And I could feel that fear and that anxiety. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, should I go in and I have to do an eye exam? Should I touch the machine where they do the eye exam? I have to go to the grocery store. Should I just carry everything in my hands or should I actually get a cart? You know, and then... Oh my gosh, it's like I touched the food, I touched the cart, I touched my wallet, I touched the credit card, I touched the keys. Like, how do I disinfect all of it?
Yeah.
I felt that not the exact same fear, but I felt that level of fear and anxiety that I had felt a couple of years ago starting to creep up again. And I had to, having, you know, a little bit more time on my hands than I've had in recent months, decided to just revisit some of the materials that I had been reading back a couple of years ago that caused me to kind of really rethink my situation and to try to apply that again for, yeah. You know, lack of a better term. So
I can relate to so much of that. And what would you say is the most powerful thing that you read that helped you shift perspective or helped you get peace of mind through all that?
Well, it's really kind of getting an understanding and a handle on fear. I think that's the biggest takeaway, and the biggest fear that I think any of us would have would be that fear of death, that fear of no self. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of spiritual practices. There are a lot of religions that try to hypothesize what it is that comes after our, you know, this experience that we're having on planet Earth right now. But ultimately, none of us knows at all for
right.
sure
yeah.
what is going to happen afterwards. So we kind of, I mean, some people just ignore it completely. You've got, you know, you've got your agnostics and your atheists and your whatnot. Then you've got people who are religious who are clinging to a particular storyline that might bring them comfort as to what comes next. And I think, I mean, I'd written in my notes here about the idea of having kind of that spiritual operating system, you know, and maybe spirituality isn't for everybody, but I do feel like it's part of the human experience. We have this hole inside of us that, you know, this we're seeking to understand who we are and where we come from and what our purpose here is. I mean, not our purpose as far as, you know, college and career is concerned, but our greater purpose, or like, why is there a universe? Why is there a planet Earth? Why are we even existing in this time space reality? And we're all just, we've got these questions and we're looking for a way to scratch that itch, to kind of, you know, provide some kind of an answer, some sort of a, you know, a creation myth or some reason for our existence. And ultimately, we'll never know if any of them is true. But I had written earlier that having something that you can fall back on in that regard, and if it has a story that would allow you to cope with that fear of no self or that fear of death, that especially at a time like this, that that really might serve you. But ultimately, it's what I kind of came to in all of this and in doing all of my reading. I don't know if you've ever heard of this author, Jed McKenna. I'd sent you a few things about it. We don't know anything about Jed. It's a pen name. You know,
yeah.
He's released maybe a dozen books. I mean, who? I mean, I've gone through this for years and years because I've been reading his stuff for about a decade. And now I'm like, okay, so is he really a baby boomer aged enlightened master living in a certain part of the world, you know, writing anonymously through his own self-publishing company? Or, you know, is this crap being written by the Tavistock Institute to, you know, further confuse us?
Yeah, right.
I really don't know. But I have found for myself a great deal of comfort and wisdom. Not even comfort, because Jed doesn't talk about comfort. He essentially talks about stripping away everything that you know and everything that you believe until all that remains is true, you know, is what's true. And for him, that is that there you can't really know anything other than that you exist. Mm. And
that you die,
and that you die. those are the two things essentially, that you exist and that you die. And that one of the things that he talks about is kind of a constant awareness of death. You know, maybe not constant, but a frequent. So in my office, I've got a second monitor over on my wall there, and I've got a picture of Chester Bennington, who was the lead singer of Linkin Park, or lead screamer, as the case may be.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I was a big Linkin Park fan, and Chester was born on March 20th, 1976, the same day I was.
Wow.
And he hung himself in July of 2017. And that rocked my world, absolutely rocked my world. I mean, not just because I was a Linkin Park fan, but I'm like, well, shit. I mean, this guy was born on the exact day that I was. And from all appearances, you know, he was a multimillionaire, multi-platinum selling rock star. I mean, he'd been popular for going on 20 years now. I mean, you would think that of anybody that this guy would be so in love with his life, but for whatever reason, he had such a level of despair that he chose to take his own life. And so for a while after he passed, you know, I'm like, okay, so he and I had been on these, you know, been alive a similar amount of time, and now he's gone, and yet I continue on. And so I made up this little thing with his picture that says memento mori next to it, which is a phrase that Jed uses a lot in his books, which means remember your death. And in the books, he's calling for you to keep death in the forefront of your mind, not because you are a depressed person or you're a morbid person, but that it kind of, if you can ultimately really accept the fact, I mean, we are all going to die, accept that fact and kind of get used to the idea. I mean, because most of us, we put it off. You know, we either say, okay, well, you know, that's going to happen in, you know, 50, 60 years. It's way down the road. So you don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, I've got these things happening in my life. I've got my family. I've got my career. I've got, you know, this and that. And you're kind of distracting yourself from it. And so you're not giving it any attention. And you're like, you know, oh, I don't have to worry about that. You know, so I've got these things. But it doesn't change the fact that it is going to happen. And then we find ourselves in a crisis like what we have right now. And suddenly all of that non-attention that you know, all of the ignoring of death that you've been doing all these years, suddenly you've got this tremendous fear that, oh my gosh, I could catch this thing and I could die. Or it could happen to someone close to me. And you haven't engaged it enough to be prepared for that, and it sends you into this state of panic.
It slaps you in the face. It really does. Yeah.
And that's what we're experiencing in the whole, I mean, when we talk about, we talked earlier about these people who are just so afraid of people dying from this, that, oh, we have to keep the economy shut down because people will die. You know, it's like the fear of what could happen is so out of proportion with the response. I read this great article last night. I'm trying to remember who it was, Republican guy from the 90s. Can't think of his name, but somebody I wouldn't have agreed with then, but this made total sense where he was talking about this situation in relation to other things. And so we've gotten to the point now where we're willing to lock down our economy for as long as it takes and basically, you know, destroy our way of life to save, you know, X number of people. You know, it was going to be 2 million and then 200,000. Now it's, you know, what are 50, 60,000 they're talking about.
Yeah.
But then he was contrasting that with situations that we have all over the world. I mean, in spite of the fact that we're all sheltering at home right now, we're still saber rattling with China in the South China Sea. You know, we just flew some military planes really close to Taiwan, I think just yesterday. And, you know, we're still talking tough with Iran and we've got all these things going on. And it's like, there seems to be a huge disconnect about our willingness to destroy our economy to save 50 or 60,000 people with comorbidities who might be dying within the next 2 years anyway, versus like, oh, well, of course we'll sacrifice tens or hundreds of thousands of people or possibly millions if a conflict were to escalate into a nuclear war. It's like, okay, well, of course we'd sacrifice these people for a war, but we will, you know, we're more than happy to sacrifice our economy to save
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the only thing, my only objection to anything that's being said right there is, for a very long time, we obviously have a lot of momentum at this point with not knowing how extensive this would be because of various things that we were told was unique about this coronavirus, right? So if people compare it to, like, well, this many people die of this every year, and this many people die of that every year, and the flu, blah, 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 then to me, like, those things aren't aligned, right?
Right.
Now, the more that this comes into focus, these are really relevant questions, especially if we are being asked to, Corbett, actually, you wanted to talk about Corbett, so here we go. Corbett had this great 8-minute video, I think, a day or two ago. And he's saying, let's get it out there and talk about what you're supporting, right? And it's just a thought experiment that he's asking people watching him to do, because I think he's probably getting a lot of criticism for his approach to various aspects of this. But, like,
sure,
if you're supporting this, that everybody, using his language, has basically been locked in their homes, and, we're talking about dramatic, like, overnight expansion of the surveillance state, major changes to people's economic freedom, to their most basic civil liberties. All right, if you're supporting this so far, everybody, let's know what your lines in the sand are, right? Let's know where the government goes one step too far as you're concerned, so we can hold you to it when they cross that line, if they will, and they might.
Right.
So now that we're looking at that as a real possibility, yeah, I think the discussion has shifted away from, if that was being used to say, like, this many people die of the flu, or this many people die in car accidents, that didn't match up with what we were seeing. But now to say, like, okay, this is not the Black Plague. We know that. So how much economic and civil liberty are you willing to trade to be protected, finger quotes, from this thing?
Right.
Right. Now I think it is time for that conversation.
Indeed. Prior to our Corbett divergence there, I was talking a lot about death. and there were just a couple of quotes that I wanted to share with people.
That's right, yes.
In regards to wrapping up. So a couple that I found particularly profound were that if you understand the fact of your own death, that it's always here with you, and that it's a certainty, then you're free. And then death gives definition to life. Death awareness is life awareness. Death denial is life denial. We spend our lives and our life force running away from this monster we call death. The state of incessant denial takes all of our time and energy, and that's where our lives go, and that's how we spend them. And so that last one really kind of encapsulates where I was coming from. So it's like, how do you want to spend your life? Do you want to spend your life living in fear? I mean, because what kind of life is that? It's like what you were talking about with Tom last week. We're all sitting in our homes. Yes, we're still alive, but we're not really living. And having this awareness of death and allowing it to, Jed talks a lot about in his books, once you have this awareness and you can kind of let go of that fear of dying and then allow for the gratitude that this death awareness would actually bring to you, because you wake up and every morning is another day. It's a new day. You can be grateful for the fact that that day is there. It's another day that I get to spend with my family. It's another day that I get to spend, helping raise my daughter. It's another day that I get to work with a client with Test Drive Your Future to help them get their lives dialed in. And when you're no longer just bound by that fear, you can just appreciate. I mean, every little thing takes on a whole new meaning, and you're able to appreciate that just on a completely different level. And so, if there was any message that I would want to share, I mean, I thoroughly recommend these books. Highly recommend these books. If you've got an Amazon affiliate link, if Brett puts these in the show notes, buy them, buy the books, just let me know what you think. If you want to have a conversation in the Facebook group or whatever, I think that it's a very worthwhile thing to do. And what I've been talking about in regards to death has also been very, esoteric, but I mean, again, bringing it to that gratitude, that appreciation, allowing you to live your life more fully with fewer regrets, I think is ultimately the point. And there's a lot of practical things that you can do as well that have really helped me, we're wanting practical takeaways that aren't so woo-woo. It's like one of the ways that I've become really comfortable recently is my wife and I got some really kick-butt life insurance policies. So I know if something were to happen to me or to Beth or to Nora, that, you know, our family would be taken care of. We've gotten our wills. We've basically gotten everything in order. If something were to happen to one of us, I can rest a lot easier knowing that things would be taken care of. They'd be taken care of financially, whatnot. So that's some really practical advice, I think, that people could, if they're not prepared in that way, with what could happen in the event of untimely demise or unforeseen tragedy, something that could bring a lot of peace and hope. In regards to my wrap up, I would really encourage people to take advantage of this time. I mean, it's like a giant pause button has been hit on all of our lives. And Richard in Autonomy talks about getting rid of liabilities in our lives, you know, and when you're going into autonomy, it's like, what liabilities can you get rid of? Can you, you know, get rid of Netflix or Hulu or video games or, we've had a lot of internet slowdowns and whatnot recently because of all the streaming video that people are watching, but it's like, take advantage of this time to do a little reflection, some introspection, to spend that time with your family, getting to know your spouse or your children, your significant other, whomever you happen to be close to in your space, just making some really strong connections with your family and making some really good memories. I mean, this is a tragic situation, but if Nora were to go back to preschool next month, I would be remembering this time fondly for the rest of my life. And I will be trying to recreate elements of this quarantine because it's not been all bad. And if I can bring some of these positive aspects that we've experienced into my everyday life, once life gets back to whatever normal is going to be from here on out, then I think we'll be better off for it.
Awesome. Thanks, Jim. That was great. I love this contemplation of death thing, and I love it. What I mean is I don't love the activity of doing it. I love that you talked about it so I can remind myself and find resources for doing it more. But through that contemplation, yeah, it lets you get up every morning and appreciate an opportunity to live in the alternative to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, you know what, everybody, I'm sorry. I'm going to say this, and I understand this is a stretch. But it's kind of like working from home without a set schedule. You just don't appreciate time, right? You just feel like if you don't think about start points and stop points, your time just seems infinite and you don't appreciate it, you know? But if you say 3:00, I'm out the door. I mean, just pretend this is a different world. I'm out the door. I'm in my car and I'm going to the gym and everything has to happen between 8 a.m. and 2:45 p.m. today. Once you train yourself in that, you can be much more effective. So scale that just to your entire life. I think that's kind of, without the woo-woo, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, we absolutely.
Yeah. Lots of productivity people will tell you, like, imagine your funeral. Imagine what looking back at your life is like, and then take that down into pieces and don't, like, reverse engineer that all the way down to the day. Yeah.
Yeah. Two more sentences from Jed. He suggests that you measure your life in weeks or months instead of years and take a somber note of their passing. Take time every morning to understand what it means to have a new day. And I'll wrap up with this last quote. If you knew you were going to die tomorrow, what would you do today? And why the hell aren't you doing it?
So I said, hey, darling, why don't you turn on your light? I said, hey, baby! Why don't you turn on your little thing? Yes, I do. I just a whip it on me. I just a little bit higher. Whip it on me. I just a little bit higher. Why don't you let it shine? A little bit higher. Let it shine. I just a little bit higher. I just got to get you. Just a little bit more, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. got to have, and I just got to get some, a little bit more, and I just need a little more, satisfy me, just got to get some more, satisfy me, I got to keep on pushing.